Hello and welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I am Marina de Koning-Thijssen, I'm a neurologist and head of the Expertise Center Movement Disorders in Groningen, the Netherlands. Today we're in the first episode of the Myoclonus special series and I'm happy to introduce John Kevines, Professor of Neurology and Director of the Movement Disorders Laboratory of the Mayo Clinic in Arizona. We will discuss the topic Myoclonus, new classification and treatment. Professor John Kevines was trained in the Mayo Clinic and also at Queen Square in London, UK. And his main topic of interest are myoclonus, electrophysiology of movement disorders, EEG, and other movement disorders. He led the recently published initiative to make a new classification of myoclonus. John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Maria.
I would like to start by asking you, there was a new classification made. Can you say something why you thought that was necessary and what's new about the classification?
Yes, the former classification that was authored by Marsden, Hallett, and Fawn, I think, Marina, served us well for like over 40 years for a long time. However, at the same time, it aged and became somewhat outdated and really needed to be revamped, if you will. A lot of the terms in the old former classification were not only outdated, but at times they're even erroneous. For example, essential myoclonus. Vast majority of essential myoclonuses, they're not idiopathic, they're genetic, and they're not even essential. They're not just isolated cases of myoclonus. So if you were somebody trying to learn myoclonus and you went into the Marsden Hallett Fawn classification and tried to learn about essential myoclonus, you'd probably get the very wrong idea about it. And so that, I think, was concerning to a lot of us. Also, there's been so much genetic information that is new about myoclonus and so much neurophysiological information that's new about myoclonus really wasn't incorporated almost at all into the former or older classification. So there really was an opportunity here to take a different approach. And if I may go on, we had some work done for us, if you will, by the classifications that were done by the Movement Disorder Society for tremor and dystonia. And they adopted an axis approach, with axis one being clinical characteristics and axis two being etiology. And so we thought that was a good template to build on for the sake of myoclonus. We also did a few things different, and I could go into that if you wish, but that was why we thought the former classification needed to undergo some substantial revisions.
Yes, I'd like to go into that a little bit more, John, because I think what's interesting, like you said, we have the clinical axis and the etiology axis, but with myoclonus, we added an 1B, which is the clinical neurophysiology axis that was not included in the dystonia and tremor classification. Can you say something about that, why you think that is important in myoclonus?
Yeah, I think that was a critical move on the panel's part. Neurophysiology is very part of myoclonus, and we use neurophysiology to not just classify myoclonus, but we use neurophysiology to decide what might be the best treatment approach. So it's not just important, Marina, I think academically, I think it's important for clinicians as well. What we did is we made it, as you say, part of Axis 1B. So you could take clinical characteristics and neurophysiological characteristics of myoclonus and then let the clinician formulate the syndrome that it might form into. And so I thought it was very important. Physiology is important for other movement disorders as well, of course, but I might humbly make the argument that it's probably even more important for myoclonus in the way clinicians need to think about it.
Yes. And then what I like in the classification is then you then move on to the clinical syndromes, right? There have been syndromes defined in tremor and in dystonia as well. But it was interesting to see that the classification ends up with 7 syndromes. And I think that's a nice way of making it a bit more simple for the clinicians. Can you say something about those syndromes?
Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head. The syndromes is what the clinician sees in the clinic. And so it really is what presents to the clinician, and not in an academic way, I would argue, but in a very clinical way. And then once the clinician is able to define or characterize the syndrome, let's move on to etiology. But I think it's very important that the syndrome lets them define what the patient has and is going through, and lets them lead to trying to figure out what the etiology of that syndrome may be. And it's important to know that any one Lyakhonis syndrome can, of course, have numerous etiologies, not just one.
Yes, I really like that about the new classification. And talking a bit about the electrophysiology a bit more, because in the physiology part, you actually define, based on your findings, where in the nervous system you think the myoclonus originates from. So from cortical or cortical subcortical or subcortical spinal. Can you say, based on your experience and also on the literature, what is the most common one of all these types of myoclonus? Because I think some of them are very rare and some are quite common.
Yes, and I would say that cortical myoclonus is by far the most common. We see it in a variety of etiologies, and cortical myoclonus is, in my experience at least, also most commonly multifocal in distribution, and it characterizes itself that way. It may have seizures associated with it, it may not, but I think cortical is by far and away the most common etiology. And that's important to realize, I think, because I think that also can help you typify the syndrome, because with cortical myoclonus, there may be other cortical clinical problems there as well, such as cognitive dysfunction. I mentioned seizures. And then also when we get the treatment, acknowledging the cortical source of the myoclonus is very important to acknowledge.
And I fully agree with you that cortical is by far the most often seen myoclonus. And if you see that type of myoclonus in your outpatient clinic, what is then the main causes that you think of? Because we all know about the genetic disorders, but at the end, they're usually quite rare. What are the causes that you would consider as a clinician?
Yeah, I think, Maria, the causes, they, and see if you agree, but they may differ according to what kind of clinic you have, whether you have a referral center or whether you have just a clinic that kind of sees all kinds of neurology. Common causes of myoclonus, it's a little bit hard to talk about because there's no one cause of myoclonus that causes the majority of cases of myoclonus. And so you're talking about causes that you may be post-hypoxic myoclonus, a clonus due to, as you say, genetic progressive myoclonic syndromes, drugs, metabolic causes are also very common. Metabolic causes particularly common in the hospital setting. But I would say those are the most common causes of myoclonus that a referral center perhaps would see.
Yes. And just one step back about the electrophysiology, because I know you're very good at electrophysiology and you have all the setup for that, but not everyone has an electrophysiology possibility in his clinic. Do you think then that it's necessary to refer all the patients to a referral center? Or do you think that most of the patients can be based on clinical grounds also be classified by the type of myoclonus?
Yeah. First of all, Maria, you're very kind, but I would say that whenever possible, referring it to a neurophysiology lab would be ideal. But of course, all over the world, that is just not always possible. So if we're thinking about typifying the syndrome, or if we're thinking about getting into treatment, because cortical myoclonus is so common, if you suspect an etiology that is likely to give rise to cortical myoclonus, you see a multifocal distribution, or you have some other clinical association that might make a cortical myoclonus, I think it's okay to do that. The only thing I would say is that fairly widespread is the ability just to do EMG. And if you can do EMG, you can also do surface EMG. And just characterizing the surface EMG myoclonus discharges can be useful as well in cortical myoclonus. As a paper that your group recently has put out, the discharges are considerably shorter than they are in subcortical myoclonus, and perhaps shorter than other causes of myoclonus as well. So if you can at least use that surface EMG to back up a presumed cortical cause, I think that helps.
Thank you. And you've spoken already a few times, you mentioned the treatment. Can you guide us through how you treat a patient with cortical myoclonus, where you start and how you approach that?
Yeah. Cortical myoclonus being cortical myoclonus, and the analogy, if you will, with epilepsy, we use anti-seizure medications, mostly in cortical myoclonus. The ideal being is that a seizure is hyperexcitability, a paroxysm of hyperexcitability in the cortex. Cortical myoclonus is also a hyperexcitability of that cortical physiology. And so we often start out with the agent Keppra or levetiracetam. There's areas of the world that clinicians can use piracetam as well. That usually is used as a first line. The unfortunate thing is, though, is that often the treatment is incomplete. It doesn't work 100%. And the clinician is often, I don't want to use the word forced, but often compelled to add on other agents as well. Alternate first-line agents for myoclonus would be valproic acid, as well as clonazepam, and some people would argue perampanel as well. But you have to be cautious in adding on agents to the first-line agents, because you're going to get more side effects, and you got to really make sure that when you add a second agent for cortical myoclonus, and certainly a third, that you're getting more efficacious treatment and trade off for any side effects that you will begin to see. But those are, I think, the first line agents, the alternate first line agents, and the way that the treatment is approached. But to be honest, Marina, it's difficult. Myoclonus treatment is well short of where we want it to be. And we have a lot of progress to be made there. And also good clinical trials are uncommon as well in myoclonus treatment, unfortunately.
Yeah, because I share your experience that you usually end up with multiple medication. Say I start with levetiracetam. If you add the other ones, do you try to reduce the levetiracetam then a bit, that you have a bit lower dose of each of the three, or how do you titrate that?
Yeah, I do exactly that, Marina, and the main reason is to reduce the side effects. These agents can be synergistic with each other, and so I don't want to keep patients with myoclonus on a maximal dose of one agent when it's really not in their best interest to do so, because you can't assume that an agent like Keppra is playing the same role in the treatment as it is when it's combined with another agent. And so you got to work for the minimally maximal effective dose of each of your combination.
And then a final question about treatment. Like we talked about the classification of myoclonus in line with the classification of tremor and dystonia. And in tremor and dystonia, you have medication as well. But if it all doesn't work, we try deep brain stimulation, right? DBS. Do you have any thoughts? Because there have been a few cases published on DBS with myoclonus. Do you have any experience with that? And do you have any thoughts of that?
I think it should be considered. There's certain etiologies that are probably better studied than others. For instance, if you have a patient with a genetic myoclonus dystonia, deep brain stimulation, I think, can offer them something that's valuable. If we're discussing a case of cortical myoclonus due to post-hypoxic injury, I think the jury is still out on that. I think we still need to understand better it's efficacious there, and even as which target might be better, because different targets have been used. So I still think there's much to be sorted out there. But I think you bring up a very good point, because as clinicians, when we have a myoclonus patient where everything has not worked, they're going to ask about brain surgery. And so you have to consider it, but it should only be considered very carefully because of the amount of data we have and don't have. But I would say probably the best case for it is in genetic myoclonus dystonia.
Yeah, that's not the cortical myoclonus, right? So we have to work harder to find out perhaps if it is also feasible and helpful in cortical myoclonus. But there is, as you said, very little known at this moment. There have not been much cases published. So something for the future.
As you know, Marina, when somebody has a patient or a couple of patients that have a good result, they publish those results.
Yeah.
But then you and I both hear about cases where the outcome was not as good for the patient as we would have liked.
Yes, I agree. Well, John, thank you so much with this perhaps aim for the future to see for new treatments for myoclonus patients. And thank you for all your insights in the new classification. I think we're coming to the end of this first episode on the myoclonus special series. And thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.